From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn about the anti-LGBTQ practices taking place at some Wisconsin voucher schools. Then, we'll learn about the Wisconsin Bike Federation's push for more bike and pedestrian-friendly communities.
Wisconsin used to be the second most bike-friendly state in the country. We've slipped to number 29. Out of 50 states, we are 49th in what we spend improving biking and walking in our state.
Plus, we'll head to Sun Prairie to learn about Odyssey Sangria, a canned sangria company founded by Milwaukee mixologists.
It's pretty awesome, just the idea of like being able to use modern techniques and make these cool, fresh, you know, products. I never would have thought 7-8 years ago that this is where we'd be.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Wisconsin's school choice program has been popular among parents and students since it first began in the early 90s. Since 1998, religious schools have become an increasingly large part of the program and now account for 95% of participating schools. Despite the fact that they get public funds, these schools aren't held to the same standards as public schools and are legally allowed to discriminate against students. A recent report by Wisconsin Watch found policies that discriminate against LGBTQ students and families are commonplace in these schools. Phoebe Petrovic is an investigative reporter for Wisconsin Watch, and she joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to share more.
So the schools that are being talked about in this report, these are schools that are being given a lot of public funding in the form of vouchers. And I think a lot of people would assume this kind of discrimination would be illegal. Why isn't that the case?
Yeah. So I looked at voucher schools, which are private schools that take public funds. And because of the way that federal and state law is set up, they are able to engage in behavior or treatment of LGBTQ or disabled students that would be illegal in public schools, even though some of the schools we looked at have 100% of their students on publicly funded vouchers. So my series looked at treatment of disabled students or students with disabilities and also students who are LGBTQ plus. And so the laws are sort of different regarding both on this federal level, but at the state level, there is no law protecting LGBTQ plus or disabled students from discrimination once they are enrolled in a voucher school. So our state law limits how voucher schools can admit voucher students, but once that student is enrolled, school policies apply. And so if they decide that it's intolerable to have a gay or trans student and they want to expel them, they can. Federal Title IX, which is supposed to be the non-discrimination law at the federal level, it exempts religious institutions from complying with anti-discrimination laws if it runs counter to their religious beliefs. Rather, I should say, you know, federal Title IX has a religious exemption, and 95% of voucher schools in Wisconsin are religious.
So putting aside the fact that public funds are going toward supporting religious institutions, as you mentioned, many of these schools have anti-LGBTQ plus policies. What do those policies really look like?
Yeah, so it runs the gamut from explicitly saying that if there is a student who is gay or trans and wants to live fully in their identity, that they could be disciplined or expelled. I found at least 17 schools that had some policy specific to trans kids in particular, saying that trans students could not be referred to with the pronoun that aligns with their gender identity or their name. So if you were assigned male at birth, if you were born a boy, but you are a trans girl, the school will refuse to acknowledge you as a trans girl, you know, requiring trans students to use the bathroom that aligns with their natal sex instead of gender identity, even going so far as to say that students can't self-administer puberty blockers that might be prescribed by a doctor if those are intended for gender transition. It really runs the gamut. And then we also looked at, because I was looking at handbooks and also the websites and policy statements and documents I could find online for 123 schools, I found schools that didn't have anything explicitly discriminatory or exclusionary in their handbook, but instead they said that they had a statement of faith that underlaid everything, you know, that the school did. And that statement of faith would say things like, we believe that there are two God-given and immutable sexes, man and woman. It's a sin to be transgender. It's a sin to be gay and be in a gay relationship or marriage. Those schools too, we counted in this because as I spoke to an education scholar who said, you know, that can have a discriminatory intent behind it, even if it's not further codified in a policy.
So one of the things this report looks at is essentially how this school-sanctioned discrimination filters down to the students in other ways. How does this end up playing out for kids at these schools who are LGBTQ+?
Yeah. So one of the things that I've been hearing in response to this, the reporting, and sometimes pushback to the reporting, is that adults will say, well, families have the right to choose the school that aligns with their values. So if parents don't want a Christian education, they don't need to send their children there. And what that misses is that there are human beings, people, children who go to these schools who might be LGBTQ and their parents don't know. And then they're forced to be in an environment that might be antagonistic to them. So in this most recent story, or this last story in the series, featured the story of Nat Worth, who was actually the valedictorian in 2019 of Sheboygan Lutheran. And he was closeted all through high school. He didn't want to go to the school, but he didn't have a choice. And he was forced to sit through classes where teachers would make homophobic and transphobic statements. And, you know, he was told that who he is sinful. And that can have a really damaging effect, you know, on a student's self-esteem. You know, Nat has done a lot of great work to put that trauma behind him, but it was really difficult. And that's one of the things that students who had actually experienced this and advocates have mentioned to me, is that it's one thing for a parent to decide they want their child to go there, but that child is their own person who might have their own identity that it's not safe to disclose to the parents, or the parents don't agree with, and they might encounter those assumptions. Or those, you know, damaging behaviors. An LGBTQ activist I spoke to, Ali Muldrow, also expressed concern that having policies that make it okay to treat LGBTQ people differently or to discriminate them sort of sends a message to the kids that they can do that too. So that it's kind of like creates a culture of harm.
I mean, I think that makes sense if kids are getting the message that these are people who are unworthy in some way or less than in some way, it does stand to reason that they would treat them as such.
Yeah, I mean, the quote from the advocate was, she said that you're sending a message to kids who identify as LGBTQ that they're not wanted and not welcome, and that you're sending a message to all students, ones who don't identify as LGBTQ, that it's okay to make LGBTQ students feel unwanted and unwelcome.
This is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers, and I'm speaking right now with Phoebe Petrovic from Wisconsin Watch. For all intents and purposes, if these schools have 100% voucher kids, to me these sound like public schools. We might not call them that, but they do seem to be public schools. And yet they are, of course, discriminating against a large portion of the public. School choice has really been championed by a lot of politicians, but specifically Republican politicians in Wisconsin. Has anyone spoken out about what's happening at these schools, about these discriminatory policies?
Mm-hmm. So I've seen on Twitter that various Democrats in the Senate and the Assembly have been sort of outraged about the reporting. The thing that I want to know is, you know, I didn't bring anything new to the fore. You know, I spent a lot of time looking through 123 schools' materials, but this has been the status quo for decades, you know, since school choice was expanded to permit religious schools to receive vouchers. None of this was new. This has been sort of the status quo for a long time. And people like Nat Worth or other students have been sort of suffering in silence while they attend schools that are subsidized by taxpayers, you know, that can discriminate. And that's sort of one of the key thing that I want to bring home, is that I've had people respond to the series being like, well, this just comes across as you don't like private schools. Private schools are allowed to do what they want. They have freedom of religion. And what my story and series really tried to surface was that these are publicly subsidized, publicly funded private schools. As you said, Some of them, 32 of them, have 100% of their students on vouchers. And public schools would not be able to act this way. It would be illegal for public schools to treat students in this way. And so that's really sort of the rub here, and the policy question that people are raising is like, should we permit public dollars to support private schools that are allowed to act differently and in a way that would be illegal if they were public?
It does seem like this kind of bigotry has been cloaked behind religiosity, but of course a lot of things have been justified through religious beliefs, perhaps most notably in our nation's history, slavery and segregation. Are there limits to this religious exemption, and are we seeing any efforts to define these limitations?
So currently, there's only one state in the entire country that prohibits this sort of discrimination in a voucher program. That's Maryland. And a religious Christian school is currently challenging that policy in court. So that's winding its way through the court. And you're absolutely right. The education and law and legal scholars that I spoke to pointed out that through the 1900s, sincerely held religious beliefs was a way to justify exclusion of Black students and was used to support and justify segregation. And eventually in the 80s, the US Supreme Court said that you couldn't use a religious exemption to justify segregation and white supremacy. These legal scholars and education scholars have proposed that the question has now evolved to whether or not it is legal or constitutional for churches or religious institutions to justify anti-LGBTQ discrimination on the basis of religion. But that's really a question that needs to be debated or sort of duked out in a courtroom right now, and hasn't really been, certainly not at the Wisconsin level. And part of that is, you know, I've heard from education advocates who prior to this Supreme Court election, you know, they were worried about bringing a case before the Wisconsin Supreme Court and creating bad law that would create worse precedent for kids. Justice Brian Hagedorn is considered a swing justice, but he is a co-founder of and sits on a board of a private Christian school that bans gay people. The difference being that they are not a voucher school. They don't take vouchers, but, you know, there was a concern about creating worse precedent. And with this new election of a liberal justice to the Supreme Court, perhaps that could be challenged in Wisconsin.
Well, we will see what the future holds. Phoebe, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you so much for having me.
Phoebe Petrovic is an investigative reporter at Wisconsin Watch, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. You can find the full report at WUWM.com. It's Wisconsin Bike Week, and many people are choosing to hop on the bike to get around instead of using a vehicle. But reckless driving incidents are also on the rise in Milwaukee, and we've all seen the Milwaukee swoop or slide, where a driver pulls into the bike lane to get around a turning driver or cut through traffic. Bike safety may be a barrier for some when deciding whether or not to ride. But the Wisconsin Bike Federation is working to increase safety and awareness about how bike-friendly cities can be better for everyone. Kirsten Finn is the executive director, and Jake Newborn is the assistant director of the Wisconsin Bike Fed. They join Lake Effect's Mallory Chang, and Newborn starts by addressing bike safety.
Bicycling in general is a very safe activity. You know, I know that people see and hear about the Milwaukee slide, and we hear talk a lot about reckless driving, and that's something to be concerned about. I think that's part of our work to advocate and encourage the city to build protected bike lanes, to build separated infrastructure, and create places where people 8 to 80 years old can feel safe riding their bike. That being said, riding a bike is fun. It's great. It's fun with friends. It's obviously in the summer. Yeah, we're seeing more and more people get out there too. And I think doing your best to follow the rules of the road, ride in a safe place, be alert and aware as you're riding, just knowing what's around you. The same with, I think, anyone. You know, if you're in a car or a bike, we all got to share the road and make sure everyone gets home safe. So it's on everyone to work to be safer there.
And I would add that it helps to be seen and to be predictable. So wearing bright colored clothing, not riding in wearing black at night, making sure you're well lit, and then also just not making sudden moves, making sure that you make eye contact with cars before you attempt to change lanes, that kind of thing. Just using your basic common sense.
And Jake, you just mentioned also advocating for more protections for bike lanes. What changes in how street lanes and bike lanes and how the city builds those and the city infrastructure, how would that help protect bikers?
We partnered with the city to pass a complete streets policy in 2018. And then since then, we've been working with them to educate and implement across city departments to make sure that they're planning for and building facilities that protect vulnerable users. And we've seen some improvements and we've seen some projects. You know, some infrastructure takes time, but we are excited to see some of the quick build opportunities that they've done through some of the ARPA and various reckless driving funds to, you know, do these planters in the street and do flex posts and things like that. And that's good to see, but all that has to really build towards ultimate connected pathways and connected lanes, and that will help you get to one place to another. Because if you're riding and all of a sudden, you know, that protected facility or that bike lane drops off and pushes you out into cars, you know, that can feel dangerous and put bikers in a situation of uncertainty. So there's some work going on. That's great. We want to work to continue that, you know, and do that faster and make sure that each project gets that opportunity to be improved. If you have concerns in your community about a street design or a traffic concern, I would highly encourage people to reach out to their elected officials and let them know those concerns. The more that they hear from us about this, that it's important, the more likely we are to see change and have them feel good about supporting those changes.
And I just want to highlight, too, another part of the Wisconsin Bike Fed is advocating for more bikeable and walkable neighborhoods for pedestrians and bikers. Why fight for this, and who benefits from a more bikeable and walkable neighborhood?
I think that everybody benefits. I think that great bike infrastructure is a wonderful indicator of a vibrant community. And one of the things that we're really disappointed about is that Wisconsin used to be the second most bike-friendly state in the country. We've slipped to number 29. Out of 50 states, we are 49th in what we spend improving biking and walking in our state. Just like $1.48 per person on biking and walking. And so we really need to increase our investment, because it's not just beneficial for safety, but it's also a great economic driver. We know that it attracts a diverse workforce when there are active transportation options in a city.
And what does a neighborhood that is more pedestrian friendly and bike friendly generally look like?
Just more active. I mean, I think you'll see more people out walking and biking and taking advantage of those opportunities. So, you know, it's not just having a bike lane. It's having destinations and parks that are easy to get to by bike. It's having bike friendly businesses that put bike racks out front and, you know, maybe are offering a discount if you ride your bike there. And hosting, saying, hey, you know, we're going to have a bike ride from here. So it's not just, you know, that on-street infrastructure. I think it really starts when you have those are kind of leading indicators of a growth in the culture and the community and getting, you know, more people biking together.
I think you also see amenities for people who are biking and walking, like shade trees or street plantings or benches at public transit stations. I think when you have a neighborhood that really is emphasizing that streets are for people and not just for cars, you see that they are more beautiful and that people just want to be out on those streets.
You both work as staff members at the Wisconsin Bike Fed. What was your biking journey to advocate for bike-friendly and pedestrian-friendly neighborhoods and being, I'm assuming too, being bicyclists yourself? How did that all happen for you?
Yeah, I think, and I'll let Kirsten explain hers, I think they both kind of came out of, you know, unfortunate incidences. I was actually in college, just kind of riding my bike, would not have called myself a, you know, a cyclist by any means, just kind of a college kid on the cheap. And I was hit by a vehicle trying to catch a yellow light, and they T-boned me, knocked me off my bike, destroyed it. And luckily, no broken bones. I, you know, count myself very lucky in that way. But, you know, once I got back on a bike, I started kind of making friends and doing things like playing bike polo and going for rides around with, you know, and just really kind of drew me in to that community and using a bike more often. And it's continued since then. I mean, I love passing that on to my daughter and riding to school with her and teaching her those same, you know, how to enjoy riding a bike and how to do it safely. And it just kind of has become, you know, much more than you know, much more than a job. It's definitely something that I believe in and you know, tell others to that they should be doing too.
And I, you know, when I was growing up, our family only had one car. And so my parents never drove me anywhere. I always went everywhere by bike, you know, the mall or the pool. And my dad was a very serious cyclist. And as I got older, I enjoyed competing in triathlons or doing charity rides around the state. But I never really rode for transportation. And my father was hit by a car in Chicago. He used to ride his bike to work every day. And he now uses a wheelchair as a result of those injuries. And it really made me afraid to ride. And taking this job really gave me a purpose and really helped me to have a passion for trying to make things better. You know, as I've gotten older, have changed the way I ride. And now I really more enjoy riding as a way to commute, riding as a way to, you know, meet friends at a restaurant. I've bought an e-bike, so I feel like I can go to meetings on my bike and I get there and I'm not a sweaty mess. But I just have really come to appreciate riding in the city. And as Jake said, realizing that for the most part, it is much safer than riding in a car. It's a wonderful way to get around and to really appreciate your community in a different way.
This week is Bike Week, and we are celebrating here in Wisconsin and in Milwaukee. Kristen and Jake, what advice would you give to someone who is, you know, out of festivities, is celebrating, getting acquainted to what biking to work or biking as a hobby could be, but is kind of on the fence of starting? So what advice would you give them to give the extra step to start biking?
I think two kind of things. One, biking is more fun with friends. So getting out, bringing a friend along with you, finding a friend who maybe already bikes and saying, hey, can I join you on the ride is a big thing to, you know, help encourage you. Same kind of, you know, you see it with like running, right? Getting out and running or being active, working out is easier with a friend. And then also, you know, planning your route and looking at maybe using the weekend to, when you're not in a rush to get to work, to think about that route and what streets you're going to ride on. Instead of just kind of automatically taking, you know, the busiest road or the most direct route you would when you drive, taking that time to plan out a little bit more enjoyable of a route can really make a big impact and take minimal extra time, if any.
And this is such a great week to get started trying to ride your bike to work. We have commuter stations all over the city where people have coffee on a trail, bacon on a trail. And if you go to our website, wisconsinbikefed.org, there's a list of commuter stations across the city and a bunch of great events that you can join. They are free and it's a great way to meet other cyclists. And it's just a good way to try out replacing some car trips with your bike.
Jake and Kirsten, thank you both so much for being here on Lake Effect. I really appreciate you both being here today and hope to see you on one of the bike trails one day.
That would be great.
Thank you, Mallory.
Kirsten Finn is the executive director, and Jake Newborn is the assistant director of the Wisconsin Bike Fed. They spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang last June. Did you know that you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen to us on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. In about 20 minutes, we'll learn about the history of Landmark Lanes and explore why it holds a special place in so many Milwaukeeans' hearts. But first, we're heading to Sun Prairie to get a behind-the-scenes look at a new local canned sangria company. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Wisconsin is known as a beer state, both in consumption and the amount of breweries that we have. However, local businesses are starting to make an impact in the spirit and cocktail markets, especially ready-made ones. Daniel Beres is a partner at Lost Whale Craft Cocktail Bar in Milwaukee and is a nationally recognized mixologist. Recently, he and fellow Lost Whale partner Tripper Duval, along with Tom Dufek of Plainspoke Cocktail Company, decided to join the canned cocktail market with Odyssey Sangria. Inspired by their cumulative experience as mixologists, as well as recipes from northern Spain, Odyssey makes a red, white, and rosé canned sangria. It's all developed and made locally, and to find out more, I visited Daniel Barris at their canning facility out in Sun Prairie, where a fresh batch was being canned. Barris explains why they decided sangria was their drink of choice to start a company with.
If anyone kind of peels the layers back of my drink history, if you will, I worked for a Spanish hospitality group for a few years, and sangria kind of just became a passion of mine. I kind of got really into making different sangria recipes while I was there, and it became something that I kind of started to get known for. People that knew me from that place would call me the sangria guy, or, you know, Captain Sangria is a really fun one from a friend. And it got to the point where I started making it for parties and stuff, and then I just kind of started realizing, you know, if I could wanted to go buy it, I just didn't have a lot to choose from. Right. So I was like, it got to a point where I wanted to make something eventually and put it out on the market, and sangria just kind of made the most sense of all the things that I had made over the last decade.
We're just going to go over basics to start. What is in a sangria? Most often it's just kind of boiled down, maybe unfairly, to it's wine and booze, but what's in it?
Yeah, usually you're finding, like, you know, wine, most traditionally red wine. You know, you're adding some sugar, you're adding brandy sometimes, and then you're just adding fruit, either berries, citrus, things like that, and you're letting it steep and kind of just infuse over a day, maybe sometimes longer depending on your recipe, and then you're just straining it out and you have this beautiful kind of bright wine punch, if you will. We take things a little bit further than that because we can them and make them a little bit more single serve, but the essence there is still pretty much the same.
And in your effort to make the sangria just a more accessible, ready-made cocktail, because usually it is kind of an event for someone if you're hosting, you know, like, what do you think some of the barriers are to people having sangria as, like, a go-to?
I think the biggest issue is space and just the energy to have to want to do it, really. I mean, yes, we could take wine. I know a lot of people that take wine and will throw, like, a flavored vodka in there and then, you know, some sugar and call it a day and say it's sangria. You know, we all know you kind of get out what you put into things. So if you're doing it, you know, kind of the traditional route and you're taking time to cut up wheels of lemons and limes and oranges and you're putting them in wine and you're letting it steep, it's finding a vessel that's big enough, finding fridge space that's big enough, letting it sit overnight, and then tweaking and making it taste good. It's a process, and, you know, unless you've done this a whole bunch, it's not something you usually want to, like, undertake on the fly and just be like, yeah, it'll turn out great. Like, it'll turn out like something, but not always great. So we wanted to have something a little bit more reliable for people and more accessible to be able to take on the go as well.
Yeah, so you started Odyssey Sangria Company. You have a red, a white, and a rosé, and an occasional seasonal sangria as well. You were talking about your history at Metro and developing recipes, being in hospitality, knowing how to curate tastes and menus. So when it came to this recipe, when you're like, okay, what is a quintessential, say, red sangria? How did you develop what is now in these cans? What aspects were most important to you?
Oh, so for me, when it came to the red specifically, I really, really wanted to stay true to kind of the history of Spain and what you see from there. There are many different types of red recipes from Spain, types of red sangria, I should say. I focused on one that I gravitated towards, which, you know, kind of comes from, like, the northern Spain area, and it actually predates, if I'm correct, I may be wrong on this, but there's one called, like, Zura. It's like Z-U-R-R-A, or they would call it, like, Zura Capote, where they would use peaches and nectarines and then finish with, like, a little bit of baking spice. So, like, you know, cinnamon or clove, or add vanilla if they had, you know, enough money back then to do it. And for me, that was just super interesting because we all know mulled wine here. And for people that have ever been to Spain, you know, southern Spain has ski resorts and has winter, just like we do. So I wanted to make something that you know, was true to that, but also very reminiscent of things that we were used to here in Wisconsin. So our red recipe actually, you know, we kind of dialed it up on the fruit side and then still finished with that baking spice. So we have peach, we have lime, we have raspberry, and then we finish with cinnamon and vanilla. So you take a sip and you get this big, bright fruit flavor up front, and then you swallow, and then right after that mid palate goes away, it just finishes with this long, nice finish of like baking spice and vanilla. So it's pretty cool. And it's awesome to have year round because you get all that fruit. It's a refreshing drink, but that baking spice is really well welcomed, you know, during the cold winter months. So I think people have just kind of not expected that from a sangria, especially from the red. Yeah. And then with the white and the rosé, I wanted something that was a little bit more straightforward and modern and accessible to people. People are used to just, you know, going to a bar or restaurant and, you know, sometimes they're just taking whatever fruit they have, which is totally understandable. I mean, sangria is a very shared thing, and it also is meant to be useful to minimizing waste, you know, reusing wine or using wine before it's going to go bad. So we wanted to stay true to those kind of easily understood flavors that people would get when they think of sangria. So the rosé has strawberry and kiwi. Yeah, no brainers, but strawberry is also very big in Spanish cooking, you know? And then with the white, kind of same thing, bright like Valencia style orange up front, fig in the middle, a little bit of vanilla on the finish, fig, you know, you can get fig and goat cheese and, you know, on a crostini there, you know? So those were all things where like, they're familiar to people, but they're also kind of still sticking on those, you know, traditional paths that we wanted to take from.
The motto for this canned sangria odyssey is modern method steeped in tradition. So you're speaking on that traditional aspect as well. I'd like to touch upon the modern because to me, from the outside, not being in this business, the modern aspect is this whole canning process. So how does canning these cocktails, how did this help you develop different recipes or know how to work with the ingredients better and give you a better final product in the end? Because we're used to mixing it, let it steep, then it's probably poured in a pitcher in most places. Yeah. But here it is in a can. How does that make it different?
I would say the differences are we can kind of play with some ingredients that maybe previously we would be concerned about going bad or maybe having a different effect over a matter of days or things like that. Now knowing we can take something and put it into a can, and cans have even longer shelf lives than, you know, a capped bottle of beer. So knowing that and being able to say, okay, well, I can make a strawberry kiwi rosé sangria taste literally like it's day one and have a shelf life of 12 to 18 months as long as it's kept in cold storage, which, you know, it is at our distributor. And it's pretty awesome. Just the idea of like being able to use modern techniques and make these cool, fresh, you know, products. I never would have thought 7-8 years ago that this is where we'd be.
So you founded Odyssey along with Tripper Duval, who's also your partner in Lost Whale, and Tom Dufek. So what was your main motivation to make your own impact in the canned cocktail space?
I think the motivation was we've seen a lot of competition from huge companies kind of getting into the game and really throwing money behind it and stuff. And we were like, well, that's all good and well, and they do what they do and they do it well, but we're a bunch of cocktail nerds. Like between the three of us, we have roughly 40 years of experience combined, you know, and our palates are our money makers. Like we know how to balance things. We understand ingredients. We understand flavor affinity. So for us, we were like, we just really wanted to kind of put our spin on things and be able to kind of get a foothold and get something out there for our fans and for people that like what we do at our bar, as well as, you know, Tom used to do what we did as well before he got into Plainspoke and owning this facility and owning Youngblood. You know, he comes from a cocktail background as well. So for all three of us, it was just, hey, let's throw our hat in the ring and see if people gravitate towards what we do and appreciate the quality of the product and the care, you know, that we put into our product. And it's been going well so far. So yeah.
Well, speaking of the quality and the care, we're here in a smaller facility in Sun Prairie, but it's small but mighty. And we just had a little look at what the canning process is like. So can you step the audience through a brief overview of like what's the start and how does it end at that canning line?
Oh yeah. So the start is we actually get all of our wine brought in on a freight truck from California in 270-gallon totes that have been sealed off. And the moment it arrives at our facility, it basically gets hooked up to basically a giant hose that feeds it to a filtration system. That filtration system has a like 0.45 micron filter in it, which I barely understand, but it's important because that filtration system actually pulls out any yeast, and actually any, it's small enough where it actually pulls out any bacteria as well. So it prevents any bacterial growth or any yeast from secondary fermentation in our product. So we don't have wine that's going into our cans that have any sediment, anything like that. We end up with this really clean, bright product at the end of the day. So the wine gets fed into the tanks first, and then all of our ingredients afterwards. Just the wine process and filtration alone can take up to a day. And then all the ingredients being added to steep, and then bringing the entire batch down to temperature, and then to carbonate is another day, sometimes two. And then finally, by the last day, or possibly 2 days, depending on the size of the purchase order, we're canning and then kegging, because we also do recyclable disposable kegs for bars and restaurants as well throughout Wisconsin. So yeah, so it's a pretty, you know, long process to start, you know, from day one to day five or six sometimes. And, you know, we're dealing with the trials and tribulations of everyone else, you know, that kind of coming in on the tail end of this pandemic too. Sometimes we have wine delays. We only really run like a single run, like purchase order a month, to use all of that wine right out of the gate. So nothing ever oxidizes, everything goes out fresh. We don't keep product left over here in the production facility, you know, to store. Everything goes direct to distribution immediately, and then out to shelves and bars and restaurants. So yeah.
So there's a great amount of, you know, intention and attention to detail with this product.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. And with, you know, we're here in Sun Prairie, and obviously people think of Wisconsin as the brewery state. Like, there's plenty of breweries for beers and such like that. But how important was it to find a local place where you could do this? Was that a top priority to begin with, or did it happen to work out?
It was a top priority mainly because I love Wisconsin. I'm from here. I bought a house here. I have no intention of moving. So like, I didn't want to find a co-packer, you know, while it would be much cheaper to do it, you know, in California, because I don't have to ship wine across the country. I really wanted to do it here. These recipes were developed here. The essence of the brand was created here. So yeah, it was intentional to do it here. Happy accident was finding, you know, a friend who owned a production facility that happened to be my roommate 13 years ago. So that was pretty cool. But yeah, the intention was always to do it here.
What challenges or lessons has Odyssey taught you that you don't think you would have gotten had you focused on staying behind the bar?
I would say the retail side is really big. Like, I know how to make a great product. I don't know anything about marketing. You know, I've had a really great couple of meetings as of late with my distributor. They are a wealth of knowledge, you know, getting to learn just how, you know, a consumer sees things on a shelf, what they gravitate towards, you know, shelf placement, how chain grocery stores work, like all of these things that I have so much to learn still, and I probably will continue learning throughout my career. But it was very eye-opening, to say the least.
You mentioned it's still pretty new and off the ground. It's about 15 months old, but how are you feeling? Like, to be here today and you see these cans coming off the production line, going from point A to point C, D, E, F, you know, all down the line. How does it make you feel?
I feel like, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't say overwhelmed, but also like incredibly excited and optimistic. I can't believe the response we've gotten in such a small period of time. I literally just did a sampling at Ray's Wine and Spirits in Wauwatosa, and had a gentleman come up to the sampling table and grab a 4-pack of white sangria and say, "I literally came here for this because me and my wife were at Draft House in Baraboo, this like new like self-serve draft place that happens to have us on tap. And she fell in love with your sangria, and we're in town here today, and I saw that you guys are here, and I needed to come grab this for her. So thank you, this is one of our new favorite things." And I was like, well, That just gave me fuel for the next year. Like, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. So yeah, it's been wild, and I'm really excited. I have a lot of fire and ready to keep, you know, putting out new cool seasonal things, and yeah.
Daniel Beres is one of the co-owners of Odyssey Sangria and a partner at Lost Whale Craft Cocktail Bar in Milwaukee. He joined me at Cullen & Harrison Company packing in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, where a fresh batch of sangria was being canned. If you've ever waited for a movie at the Oriental Theater, you may have found yourself in the underground city for a game of pool, bowling, or Dance Dance Revolution.
The Landmark, in many ways, is kind of like Milwaukee's original activity bar. It's been here, obviously, 95 years. It's not even just one bar, it's three bars and a full bowling alley. It's a full bowling alley and an arcade.
We'll learn about the history of Landmark Lanes next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Milwaukee has a lot of bars that feel like hanging out in someone's basement, but there's none quite like Landmark Lanes. When it was first created in 1927, it would have been hard to imagine how the East Side would evolve in the coming decades. Landmark was originally a part of the Oriental Theater and Oriental Drugs, eventually becoming the underground city that generations of Milwaukeeans have come to know and enjoy. As a longtime East Sider, Milwaukee Records' Matt Wild is a regular visitor to Landmark. So Lake Effect's Joy Powers met with him there to learn more about this East Side institution.
Matt Wild, thank you so much for joining me here at Landmark.
Well, thank you for having me, and I never really need an excuse to come here, but I'm happy to be here right now.
This is a place you actually end up going a fair amount, right? Your daughter likes it?
It really is, yeah. I live fairly close to here, so I find myself these days spending a fair amount of time here at the Landmark on the East Side with my 8-year-old daughter. And we go bowling, we play video games, and we just hang out. And yeah, we're here at least once a week, sometimes two times a week. So it's a hangout.
Now, for people who have never been to Landmark Lanes, and I admit there are probably few, but how would you describe it?
Well, I think it's interesting. In the last few years, there's been such a kind of a push for these so-called like activity bars. That's been a thing in the last 5, 6, 7 years. The thinking is people just don't want to go out anymore and sit and drink. They want to go out and do something else, whether that's throw axes or paint or play board games or whatever it is. And so there's been a lot of these kind of activity bars popping up in Milwaukee in the last few years. And they're great, but I find it funny because the Landmark in many ways is kind of like Milwaukee's original activity bar. It's been here obviously 95 years, and it's not just a bar. I mean, it's not even just one bar, it's three bars. It's not even three bars, it's three bars and a full bowling alley. It's a full bowling alley and an arcade. And of course you have all the, you know, foosball and darts and all the bar games like that. And on top of that, you have comedy, live comedy here from time to time, and you have live music from time to time. So it's just this kind of entertainment center. It's an activity bar before there were activity bars. So it's called the Underground City. It's definitely underground. It's a rather large basement facility down here. And when you kind of walk down those steps, it's like you're walking into a whole new world.
I think that might be one of the oddest things about Landmark. When you're walking past, it's, you know, like an entrance like any that you might see into a storefront. But the storefront in this case looks pretty small. It's really just kind of a doorway between a couple other storefronts. And then you walk down, and it is a full bowling alley. But I mean, where we're sitting right now, it is just one of the bars. There are multiple bars down here. There's a number of pool tables. It's kind of like, I don't know, six places in one.
Yeah, I think Underground City is very apt, and they have that, you know, just a big sign that says this as you're walking down the steps. And you're right, it's like, you know, just one of these bars, the one we're in right now, I guess, is the Moon Room. And there's the front bar and the back bar, and each on their own would be a perfectly serviceable, perfectly lovely little neighborhood bar. But they're all piled on, you know, next to each other, and there's a kind of the bowling alley and the arcade, and it's all down here, and it's all kind of hidden, and I kind of like that. It's very apt. I think the Landmark is a place where I think a lot of people of a certain age have a lot of memories of this place, that coming here and kind of the heyday of like the 90s, 80s, 90s, maybe into the early aughts. And it's kind of a place that I think a lot of folks, as they get a little older, they kind of forget about it. And if I could be a Landmark advocate here, I would be here to say that it's still here. It's been here for 95 years. I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon. It's still here. It's still largely the same place that a lot of folks remember. They've been doing a little spiffing up here and there. There's a new marquee outside. There's been, you know, some nice new paint jobs in here. For folks, again, of a certain age who remember this place during the time when we could smoke in bars, it does not smell like that anymore. I think that's one of the most enduring memories of the Landmark for certain people. Just remembering this place when you could smoke and having it packed wall to wall, all three bars, and every single person smoking all night long, and just a haze in here. And I was certainly in on kind of the latter years of that, and it was one of those things where you would just, you could be here an hour, make one or two beers, and you'd have to burn your clothes at the end of the night. I mean, they would just smell so bad. And so those days, thankfully, are long gone. It's not like that anymore. But in so many other ways, it's the Landmark you've always known and loved.
So you mentioned, of course, kind of the heydays of Landmark, but we're talking about actually a space that is, 95 years old. What is some of the history of this space?
Well, as 95 years would suggest, it kind of opened more or less in 1927. It was tied in with the Oriental Theater, which is right next door, of course. And before that, it was like a horse and mule and streetcar barn. So in 27, it kind of became a bar. And in 1972, I believe, it kind of became more or less the bar that we know now, the Oriental Lanes and Theater. And they changed it at that point into Oriental Landmark Lanes. That was kind of, you know, where things were for decades after that. And, you know, even if you look on the Landmark's website, it's funny, they do refer to the like 80s and 90s as their heyday, like just people down here packed wall to wall. It's changed hands in the last decade or so, but it's really remained the same. So it's been this kind of constant thing for so many decades. So when you say 95 years, yeah, before that it was a mule barn, but it really has been kind of consistent for a good chunk of those 95 years. Even the sign that they recently changed and kind of updated outside, there was like an older sign kind of buried underneath the signs they were replacing that said Oriental Bowl that dated back more than 50 years, 50, 60, maybe even 70 years. They weren't even sure. They covered it up again. So, but the new sign does look nice. So it's the real deal. It's just kind of been this thing forever.
There was a brand new sign outside. What I found interesting about this brand new sign, looking at both the sign they replaced and the sign underneath it, remarkably little has changed.
That's right, yeah. You know, people are scared of change. People don't want change. But, you know, looking at it, it was like, sure, this new sign could have been made in the 70s or 80s. It's retro without being, I think, obnoxiously retro. So I think it's very fitting.
A continuation of an institution on the east side.
Absolutely. And that's what this place, I think, really is. And like I was saying before, it's a place that I think a lot of people have fond memories of when they lived on the east side. And maybe in the years since, they've moved on to other neighborhoods. They've moved out to Bayview or even farther flung than that. Some have gone way out to the suburbs. But the east side, I moved here way back in 1996. I've been here ever since. I've never left the east side. I've kind of just bounced around in a small radius from apartment building to apartment building. And it's really reassuring that this place and this neighborhood kind of, sure, has seen some change, but the landmark is still here. And it's something that, you know, people need to be reminded of sometimes. Maybe they haven't been to the side of town in a long time, and I am here to say that welcome. Welcome back to the East Side. It's there's a lot of things that are different, but one thing that is not different is the landmark. And it's, you know, in my view, lovelier than ever.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for joining me here at Landmark.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Matt Wild is a co-founder of Milwaukee Record and a longtime fan of Landmark Lanes. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers last year. Thanks so much for being with us today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about ways to manage pests or weeds in your yard that won't have a negative impact on the environment. Plus, we'll look at Frank Lloyd Wright's legacy in Wisconsin and how the state's landscape inspired his work. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.